Do Guerrilla Radio on CFUV 101.9 FM, 104.3 on the cable dial, and you know we're heard around the world in Shoutcast at cfuv.uvic.ca. Well, a decade into the rebranded global war on terror, what does the international community have to show for its efforts? Are there fewer terrorists threatening our way of life? Are we safer to travel to see exotic cultures and the diverse people of the planet? Is the world a more just and verdant place for the efforts of the legions of protectors and billions on billions of dollars, euros, rubles, yen, and rupees directed into the vast and varied mechanisms of the security state? An attempt by the United Nations to ostensibly make us safe from terrorists of the non-state variety is the 1267 regime. It's an international blacklist directed to target individuals deemed too dangerous to be allowed passage across borders, or within them for that matter. It's a regime the BC Civil Liberties Association decries as Kafkaesque and worse. They say it does nothing to protect those things our betters in government say they care most about: liberty, justice, and individual freedom. Carmen Chung is a lawyer with the BCCLA, where she works on litigation and legal reform. She is the author of the BCCLA's just-released report, The UN Security Council's 1267 Regime and the Rule of Law in Canada. Carmen Chung and the UN's Rule Beyond the Law in the first half. And less hopeful and certainly less hypeful than the last national election, the one that sparked, for a moment at least, in the personage of candidate Barack Obama, aspirant stirrings in the hearts of citizens believing it possible to reverse the destructive and massively unjust direction their nation had taken under the command of George W. Bush and his vandals. America is heading back to the polls for the midterm elections tomorrow. It is a decidedly darker tone this time around, with few predicting positive results for Mr. Obama's Democrats, many of whom seek to distance themselves politically from the man who 2 short years ago had a hope-starved world in the palm of his hand. David Swanson is an indefatigable social activist and political operative who has labored for more than a decade to bring some semblance of sanity into the governance of his American homeland. He is the author of the book Daybreak, Undoing the Imperial Presidency and Forming a More Perfect Union, and the forthcoming War is a Lie. David Swanson in the second half. And Victoria Street News publisher and CFUV broadcaster Janine Bancroft will join us at the bottom of the hour to bring us up to speed with goings-on happening among Victoria's unhoused community, who this weekend saw City Hall and funding to some of the familiar shelters in Victoria. Is the homeless problem then solved? Well, not exactly. Janine and turning down of the city's shelter beds at the half. But first, Carmen Chung on Canadian justice and the UN's 1267 regime. Stick around.
Hi, thank you.
Well, welcome back to the program, Carmen.
Oh, thanks for having me.
Well, it's my great pleasure, as always. Now, Carmen, for Canadians who may not recall the case of fellow citizen Abousfan Abdelrazak, and I apologize, Mr. Abdelrazak, for that pronunciation, who exactly is he, and how does his experience inform of the dangers of the UN's 1267 regime?
Well, Mr. Abdelrazak is a dual Canadian Sudanese citizen. And with respect to the 1267 regime, his experience is quite dramatic. For those of you, limited your audience who've heard of Mr. Abdelrazak, they'll know that his complaints about the Canadian government's treatment of him go beyond the 1267 regime. But for the purposes of our discussion this evening, I'll just limit it to his experience on this particular blacklist. In July of 2006, Mr. Abdelrazak was informed by a diplomat with Canada's Department of Foreign Affairs that he had been added to what was known as the United Nations Consolidated List of Individuals and Entities Associated with Al-Qaeda and the Taliban, which we commonly refer to as the 1267 list. He hadn't been told why he had been placed on this list. He wasn't told who had placed him on this list. There had been no charges pending against him in any jurisdiction. There had been no trial or hearing to even establish that he was associated with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban in any way. And so in short, he had no idea why he was on this list. And so from July of 2006 to the present, he remains on this list, and this is despite the fact that he has been yet to be charged with any terrorism-related offense, and despite the fact that both CSIS and the RCMP have both cleared him of involvement in any criminal activities, terrorism-related or otherwise. He continues to have very little access to the evidence that's been put against him in the Security Council, and he still doesn't know who's put him on the 1267 list. So what being on the 1267 list means is that he's on a terrorist blacklist and he's subject to a series of sanctions that have been mandated by the United Nations Security Council. And those sanctions take the form of an asset freeze, an international travel ban, and an arms embargo. And so what that means is that his life in Canada looks something like this. Mr. Abdelrazak lives off a very modest stipend from the government of Quebec for food and shelter, which is permitted to him pursuant to a humanitarian exemption to the asset freeze for subsistence living expenses. His only assets, a pension entitlement from his deceased wife, have been frozen. He can't travel outside of Canada, and in practical terms, it's difficult for him to travel within Canada given that his assets are frozen. And the regulations implementing the 1267 regime in Canada forbid Canadians here, or anyone here in Canada for that matter, or Canadians abroad, from providing him with any financial assistance whatsoever. And further to that, obtaining employment then has therefore been difficult because any potential employer here in Canada would have to actually seek an exemption from the Security Council in order to pay his wages.
Well, now,
the restrictions on Mr. Abdelrazak's liberties are quite severe, and he has no means of supporting himself or his three children. And so long as he remains on the 1267 list, he's also known as an associate of the Taliban or Al-Qaeda, an associate of two terrorist organizations, despite the fact that he hasn't been charged with any crime in Canada or abroad.
Yeah, so let me summarize a little bit, just for Canadians who are right now shaking their heads or trying to pick their jaws off the ground. We have a Canadian citizen here charged with nothing, placed on a list by whom he knows not. For what reason, he has no idea. He spent a couple of years in some weird twilight limbo land before finally being allowed to fly back into Canada. He cannot work, and nobody in Canada can give him work for fear of being charged with aiding a terrorist, ostensibly. He cannot travel, go back to Yemen or go anywhere else, and this is his life now. He's stuck on a welfare equivalent just to the good graces of the Quebec government, right?
That's basically the gist of it, yes.
And this can happen to anybody. I mean, even if somebody with my name gets on this list, it's going to be quite hellish for me too, right?
Well, I mean, because what you're essentially forced to do is to prove a negative.
Mm-hmm.
And as Mr. Justice Russell Vinn of Canada's federal court has said already with respect to this case, it's like proving that you're not a fairy or not a goblin. It's next to impossible.
Or you're not a witch.
It's absolutely true. The United Nations Security Council itself, its own advisors, have said that, in fact, once you're on the 1267 list, it's almost next to impossible to get yourself off.
Well, now you've done a report for the BC Civil Liberties Association, and I mentioned that the name and title of that report. And in it, you say that, well, what the UN has mandated here is actually contrary to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. Now, have we agreed to allow that the UN trump Canadian law? I missed that vote.
Well, I don't think that we have, and I don't think that we've allowed to have our international treaty obligations trump our domestic law or the Canadian Constitution. To that end, the BCCLA is actually engaged in litigation right now challenging the implementation of the 1267 regime in Canada because we are concerned about the lack of due process protections inherent in the 1267 regime itself as it's administered by the United Nations and also in the way that Canada implements it domestically.
Well, now the United Nations, I mean, for a Canadian, as we've just been talking about, finds himself caught behind this. I mean, now, this is a body in a foreign country, its base being in New York City. How possible is it for a foreign citizen, a citizen outside of the United States, to approach the United Nations and say, well, look, you've got it all wrong. And what appeal process is there?
Well, so the listing procedure is rather opaque, and the delisting procedure is even more opaque. If I can just sketch it out briefly for your audience, you find yourself on the 1267 list if any UN member state presents the Security Council with an allegation that you are somehow affiliated with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban. There's no requirement within any of the rules or the regulations setting out this regime for what the minimum standard of evidence is. There's no framework for testing the validity of the evidence or the allegation that you're a member of Al-Qaeda or the Taliban, or you're even affiliated with them. So what the Security Council does is that it effectively deliberates in secret and decides whether or not to put you on this list. And then once you find yourself on this list, you are permitted to a petition to an ombudsperson who will review your petition and then make a non-binding recommendation back to the Security Council. But the Security Council is the same organization that assembled the list in the first place, and they're also responsible for making delisting decisions. And so they'll decide whether or not they are willing to entertain the petition to delist. And if they decide not to, they're not obligated to provide any reasons for why they decided not to delist. And there is no appeal mechanism from the decision of the Security Council to keep you on the 1267 list.
Well, you called it opaque. When I'm thinking about transparency and law in the United States initially, and Canada followed suit, of course, a national security seems to trump any kind of transparency when it comes to this war on terror, whatever the rebranding name of it is now. I've lost track. But what about for an organization like the United Nations? They don't have a national security per se. So how do they maintain this opaqueness, as you describe it, in a legal framework?
Well, it's rather untenable, frankly. The Security Council exists to preserve peace and good governance and the like. As you know, the United Nations was born out of the horrors of World War II, and so the idea is that the Security Council is granted really broad authority to set out sanctions and that sort of thing in order to protect the peace between nations. So what the United Nations Charter, of which Canada and the United States and many other countries is a signatory, requires of its member states is to give effect to Security Council resolutions domestically. So that what that means is that the Security Council makes a resolution, in this case makes a resolution to set up the sanctions regime, each and every UN member state is required to make sure that there's something in their domestic legislation that gives effect to that resolution, or otherwise they would be in breach of their obligations under the UN Charter. And by its very definition, the UN Charter exists as the supreme international law. And so we find ourselves in a very peculiar situation, because if any other entity in the world had come up with a situation like this, the UN's own human rights treaties would find that would trump it and find that it to be in conflict with the international human rights regime. But because the Security Council is in a way outside of the international law, there's no effective way to challenge the Security Council's conduct here, even though what it's doing is violating all the human rights principles that the United Nations itself has promulgated since the end of World War II.
Yeah, we often think of the legal frameworks, whether they're national or international, as being designed to protect human rights and individual freedoms, not to take them away. Well, if you've just tuned in, Carmen Cheung is joining me. She is a lawyer with the British Columbia Civil Liberties Association, where she works on litigation and legal reform. She's the author of their just-released report, The UN Security Council's 1267 Regime and the Rule of Law in Canada. Well, Carmen, another Canadian who I'm very concerns, whose case really concerns me, and I can't seem to get it out of my mind, is Omer Khadr, who was just recently copped a plea in Guantanamo Bay. Well, now we Canada are signatories to a number of conventions that have been ignored in this case. What about that then? I mean, aren't we standing in breach of our obligations to the United Nations in the case of Omer Khadr, the child soldier, or shall I call him child terrorist, being held these 8 long years and subject to torture and other things, a forced confession? What about that?
Well, there, I think you're absolutely right that Canada is standing in conflict with its obligations to the international community. It's signed on to any number of conventions that prohibit, first of all, what the United States has done to him, that prohibit, the trying of a child soldier for war crimes, or for what the United States calls war crimes, and also for being complicit in his torture, which is something that the Canadian Supreme Court itself has found that Canada has done. So absolutely, yes.
Well, as a confessed member of Al-Qaeda, and I'll put square quotes around confessed, because I'm still of that sort of the post-Magna Carta school that believes confessions obtained under torture are not legitimate, as the Canadian government seems not to agree. But now, will he be placed on the 1267 regime? Should he ever be repatriated?
It's unclear. It's really up to the UN member states if the United States or Canada or anyone else wants to place him on the 1267 list. Then they would have to make an application to the Security Council to put him on.
So it's not automatic.
I'm sorry.
It's not automatic then, because he's.
It's not automatic. An application must be made. But as it stands, the terms of his plea agreement seem to suggest that he's agreed to never enter into the United States, which includes the U.S. airspace, and so his ability to travel anywhere beyond the borders of Canada would probably be quite limited.
Okay, so here we stand. Now, tell me some of the other aspects of your report, and what Canadians should be concerned about, and perhaps how Canadians can petition their government, international community notwithstanding, to address some of your concerns.
Well, our primary concerns are with the regime as it's administered by the United Nations, and the fact that Canada continues to be complicit in it. The fundamental problems with the 1267 regime were really ones of a lack of due process and fair trial. As we've described, you can find yourself on the regime really not knowing why you're on the regime at all, and not being provided with any evidence of why you're on it, not being able to really directly challenge your listing, and having no recourse to any judicial or independent review of your listing. The Security Council, in effect, acts as judge, jury, executioner mm-hmm. in this situation. And so until the Security Council manages to find some way to build in a judicial review mechanism, or in the alternative, permit its member states to judicially or independently test the listing decisions, it just doesn't comport with fundamental principles of fair trial or due process, which are the cornerstones of the rule of law and the very mechanisms that protect our human rights. You can't even get into whether or not there's been a rights violation if you don't have the mechanism to test it. And here we don't. We don't have independent courts. We don't have independent review of the decision to list.
Well, yeah, and in the press release that the BCCLA sent out regarding your paper on this, it says, well, Canada fails, I'll quote, fails to live up to its obligations under international law and Canada's constitution. But does that mean that there's a third law at work here, a star chamber within the Security Council, that international law, like what is international law? Is the United Nations Security Council trumping agreements we've made through the UN General Assembly? Or what's the difference here?
Well, the Security Council places itself by the UN Charter outside of jurisdiction of national courts, and so in a way, yes, it is immune in a manner of speaking from all of the other international obligations that bind the rest of the UN member states, all of the human rights obligations. And that's why countries other than ours, such as the UK or the European Union, for example, when faced with whether or not they can implement the 1267 regime in their own countries, have found that because the regime, as it's implemented by the United Nations, doesn't contain adequate protections in terms of due process and have struck it down. So our challenge right now is we have a lawsuit, the BCCLA, along with the International Civil Liberties Monitoring Group and Mr. Abdelrazak. We're in federal court challenging the Canadian provisions that implement the Trial 67 regime domestically, because we don't think that the way that the UN administers the Trial 67 regime and the way that Canada has implemented it here comports with the requirements for due process under the Charter and the Constitution.
Well, couldn't the Canadian government, after the last card is played in your challenge, couldn't they just say, well, yeah, we agree with you, but hey, this is our deal. We've signed on with the Security Council, and so, it might be unfortunate, but tough luck.
Yeah, I mean, to that we have, two general remarks. The first is we don't think that simply the United Nations Act permits Canada to make executive order in council, which effectively denies human rights. We don't think that the authority that Canada has given itself in terms of implementing Security Council resolutions domestically ever contemplated that there would be Security Council resolutions that would be in such stark violation of fundamental rights and freedoms. So there's that. So we don't think that Canada really has a good argument that in order to maintain its fidelity to one portion of the human rights law, it has to ignore entire swaths of the rest of the international regime.
Sorry.
And the second thing we'd like to say about that is that this is an act. It's not unprecedented that Canada disobey Security Council resolutions. For example, there's a case of an individual named Levon Hussein who found himself both on the Trial 67 list and Canada's own anti-terrorism blacklist. And the government of Canada actually found that there was no evidence against him justifying his continued listing on either of these blacklists. And it suspended the application of the 1267 regime to him, even though he remained on the 1267 list. And so when Canada did that, it was technically in violation of the 1267 regime. Now, Mr. Hussein was very shortly thereafter removed from the 1267 list, so Canada's breach of its UN obligations was fairly short, but nonetheless, it was willing to do that.
But no such similar hope for Mr. Abdelrazak?
Unfortunately not.
Well, yes, Kafka indeed. Well, we've only got like a minute left here, Carmen, but when you mentioned the process that Canada goes through to decide which United Nations agreements it's going to sign on to, then is that not, that does not go through the Parliament? Is that something that's done in the Cabinet or just the PMO's office or what?
It's done by order in council, and no, it doesn't go through Parliament. The United Nations Act, which is the domestic law here in Canada, which gives effect to the UN Charter, allows the governor and council to simply pass, to make executive regulation. And so in this case, all of the Security Council resolutions that give shape to the 1267 regime have just been implemented without any parliamentary approval.
And no debate, obviously.
And no debate, obviously, and so we think that when that authority was given to governor and council, when the UN Act was originally enacted, there was no contemplation on the part of Parliament that it be used to enact, first of all, laws in violation of Canada's own constitution and laws in violation of international human rights obligations.
Wow, that's disheartening indeed, and. And I guess we should remember, when you say the United Nations Security Council, we're talking about the five permanent members only, right? Not the extended 20-nation conglomeration with the 15 non-voting members, but this is just the five permanent members, right?
No, it includes the rotating temporary members.
Oh, well, then it really is too bad that Canada didn't get a seat on there, eh? Well, Carmen, finally, what's the next step now? Now you've got the suit going, you're publicizing your efforts. Where do we go from here?
Well, where we go from here is our lawsuit is going, and so that we hope will proceed according to PACE in the beginning of early 2011. But in terms of individuals who are interested in this, as we do with all of these things, we encourage you to write to you, your representatives and express your dismay that Canada continues to be engaged in this sort of conduct and behavior, and hope for legislative change on this front.
And bccla.org, is that your guys' site?
Yes.
Okay, so you can find out more and read Carmen's report, and I've published the BCCLA press release on my website, pacificfreepress.com, where you can find it as well. Thanks a lot, Carmen Chung, for coming on again.
And thank you very much for having me.
Well, my great pleasure. Until the next time, then. I'm going to take a brief break now, but when I come back, I'll be joined by Janine, and she's going to talk about things closer to home and some pretty disturbing developments since last we spoke, so do stick around. And welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, CFUV 101.9 FM locally, 104.3 the cable, and CFUV.uvic.ca on the internet, everywhere else in Showcast. Joining me tonight, as oft time she does, is Janine Bancroft. Hey, Janine, how's it going?
Well, before we get to this, yeah, these crazy stories from the streets of what's going on with closing shelters and such, the not-so-good news all the time, can I just share a little good news, Chris?
Oh, well, hold on a second. I've just got to gird my loin here. I'm not sure. I'm so unused to good news, and I'm not sure what might happen. Okay, go ahead.
There is some good news. There is some good news. It's 66 years today since the vegan movement began.
Well, I would have thought it would be a lot more in India.
Well, the dairy products in India, right? Don't they eat cheese and and ghee?
Is ghee made out of cheese?
Butter and stuff like that. There was a discussions began apparently at the turn of the century about among vegetarians about this the cruelty associated with other dairy products, but it was actually not November 1944. When Elsie Shrigley and Donald Watson agreed to promote something called veganism.
Wow, really? That surprises me. 66 years, that's great, but it seems a little recent, but wow, amazing.
See, it's new, it's new.
New
people
and improved.
Will join up because it's, it's shiny and new. A lot of people in Washington this weekend, hey?
Washington, D.C., yeah.
Oh, that's good news. I have to read some of my favorite signs that I saw.
Explain what you're talking about first.
On the Facebook? Well, this would be the rally to restore sanity and or fear that Jon Stewart and Stephen Colbert were organizing.
Mm-hmm.
In Washington, D.C., there was like 250,000 people or something. Bigger rallies than Washington has seen for a long time. And some very clever signs. There's some really great ones out there. One of us, or perhaps neither of us, may be right. Another guy had a sign that said, why aren't we using the metric system? There's a sign that said, my arms are tired. End is far. Hey?
Your arms are tired, like the arms industry or something?
I don't know. I just hold up the sign that said, my arms are tired.
So this is kind of silly, too, right?
It's kind of silly. Clever. Play on words there. War isn't free. Pay your taxes, teabaggers. Is this the line for Justin Bieber tickets?
Oh, that must have been a Canadian.
Yeah, I don't have a dream so much as a mild preference.
I have a notion.
And then Hitler said, I shall have my brain frozen, placed in the head of a Kenyan baby, forge a Hawaiian birth certificate, get elected president, and fulfill my most diabolical plan, universal health care in the United States.
Oh, cunning. I wonder, did they have health care in pre-war Germany under the Hitler regime? I wonder.
Don't know, but we have it in Canada, and Kenny is still in the hospital, and I heard from Nancy today. She went, and apparently over the weekend, he was begging the staff to take him downstairs. This is blind Kenny, who lost his partner of 42 years, and so he's blind, and so he's in the hospital now, which is where he was when she died, because he called 911, and then he was allowed out for her wake, and then he was taken back in handcuffs, and where he's stayed ever since. It's 2 months. So he just wanted to go downstairs. The staff refused to let him. He started getting a little upset. He reminded them he's not a prisoner and he could leave if he wanted. They said, no, you can't.
This is another Kafka-esque kind of situation where, because of his disability, he's being protected, in effect, right?
I guess. Now, why they can't find this poor fellow some housing, you know, the craziest part of this story is that he and Linda lived in a building built by the CNIB on Humboldt Street, where it was renovated, he told me, and then shortly thereafter, it was a beautiful place from all accounts. There was about 14 different units. It was small, but it was completely equipped for blind people. And then they renovated it, and shortly thereafter they tore it down, and now folks can drive by. I think it's 850 Humboldt, where they're building new low-income housing.
And can you define low-income for me? I've really lost track.
Yeah, don't know. Not sure what that might be. But anyways, there's nowhere apparently in town for them to put Kenny, and they can't just toss him out on the streets. So he's in the hospital. He wanted to go downstairs. He got angry. He was grabbed and handcuffed with his hands behind his back. This happened this weekend. Dragged back to his room where he's tied by his ankles and his wrists to the bed. He doesn't know how long he was there because they drugged him.
Oh, really?
Yeah, by the time Nancy got there, she said they prepared her for him, saying that he was grumpy, and then they went in and untied him, and she was able to take him out for a visit. Hey,
This must be like that sort of bedside talk. You know, you're dying of something or something, and you're just a little out of sorts. So he's grumpy because he's been tied to his bed and drugged because he wanted to go downstairs to have a cigarette, I'm guessing, and had to ask permission. Does he have to raise his hand to go to the bathroom as well?
Well, he doesn't smoke, but he is blind, you see, and he does have a cane. But you know, he's been up and down those stairs in the hospital a number of times, and there's nobody apparently who can take him downstairs. I mean, he's basically, when I went there, he told me he just lays in bed and cries all day. He's been in there for 2 months because he lost his partner. So anyways, while this was all happening, he told Nancy, he told my friend, that he was yelling for help and asking if someone could call a lawyer. And, well, they couldn't do that. They took away his television. I don't know if they still have the radio that our friend Christina took for him. Nancy's now going to try to go to the corporate press and see if somebody there can't make some waves. But, you know, in light of, then on the other side of the equation, there are these three shelters that are closing, right, in mm-hmm. Victoria. And now they're moving. Kool-Aid sent out a really nice sounding press release about how, don't worry, all the people from StreetLink, which is sort of the official shelter, they're all going to get moved into the new shelter. So don't worry about them. But there's two other shelters that are running out of money, as far as I understand it. And it's impossible to get any news from anywhere. I mean, I only heard about this because I happened to run into someone who I know is sort of off and on homeless on the bus last week, and that's how we were able to leak this story. Otherwise, I never would have heard anything about it. But it sounds like there's about 72 lost mats and also about 60 hot meals being lost. So, you know, they sent out a press release saying, oh, don't worry, we've got the travelers' inns, they're coming up, they're going to be renting those out. Well, I phoned about those, and they've only got funding for those for 3 months. So for 3 months, those are, in fact, going to be low income. They'll be about $375. But after that, who knows, right? So, you know, I want to believe that people are motivated to do good and that all these people are going to be taken care of as we head into winter. But then I look at Kenny and I think, you know, if they can do this to a blind man, there's just no telling what might be going on out there.
Well, yeah, this is really disturbing indeed. But if I'm getting this straight now, so because of the new shelter that's being opened, which is out in Rock Bay, which is far away from, you know, potential tourists and the new condo dwellers that are moving into the transformative downtown core of Victoria, on the other hand of it, the city or funders, who I'm not sure who is funding these mats at the St. John's Church and other places, that funding is going to be cut because it's deemed that it's not necessary because of the new shelter. Am I getting this right?
This is what I've heard. I mean, as far as I can piece it all together, and I've also heard that those people, they get $35 to $40 per person. So for every mat that's on those floors every night, they get $35 to $40, and that funding now has run out.
And
so
that's
those places are shut.
That's okay? From the City of Victoria, then?
Well, I think from the province, BC
the province.
Housing.
Okay.
I think it's the province. Maybe some of it's from the city. I'm sorry, I haven't had time to do all the investigation. I'm hoping there's other people out there who can help with that. Mm-hmm.
Well, and as you said, it's not exactly super transparent either. Getting this information isn't, you know, as easy as just looking at the list of press releases at the websites or anything, eh?
No, it's not, unfortunately. And even if you phone, you get, you know, and you phone these, I mean, I phoned Kool-Aid, you know, and I don't want to take away from the good work that Kool-Aid does, but honestly, you phone and you get a list of all these people that you can talk to, and then you get through to the housing people, and there's another four people there that you can choose from. And, like, how institutionalized does this crisis have to become? I mean, when I moved to Victoria in 1990, there was none of this going on. There was a few homeless people here and there, but there's 1,200 people. I was at Food Not Bombs yesterday. I was talking to this guy from Geneva about, you know, what's going on in Geneva. He said they've totally cleaned up the city there. They've shut down all the squats. I mean, it seems to be ongoing. They just think that if they can clean these people away somewhere, you know, that poverty won't exist anymore. When I told them there were 1,200 approximately people in Victoria, I couldn't believe it.
Well, listen, Janine, we're running long, so we're going to have to wrap it up. So your program, you'll be following this, I expect, Thursdays, 11 a.m., alternating Thursdays, Winds of Change right here at CFUV. Street News is out for November, and there's much in there to keep track of, especially with Kenny, the story that you mentioned. There's an extended piece on that, right?
Yes, there is. And also at my blog and my radio blog, JanineBancroft.wordpress.com. Also, just quickly mention that David Johnson's back in jail. He got tired of, he was trying to challenge this bylaw that they put in to say that you can only put your tent up overnight.
Mm-hmm.
He thinks you should be able to sleep outside in the daytime if you need to. So he challenged the bylaw. He's waiting for the verdict from the court. He got tired of waiting, so he set up a tent and immediately was taken back to Wilkie. So he is currently at Wilkinson Jail where he does not eat.
And he's fasting in jail again as all good political prisoners do. Okay, Janine. Oh, well, you're doing important work, and we appreciate it a lot. Until the next time, then, eh?
Thank you.
Okay, bye-bye. All right, I'm going to take another brief break and come back with David Swanson in just a second.
I'm just an American boy, raised on MTV, and I've seen all the kids in the soda pop bands, but none of them look like me. So I started looking around for a light out of the dim. And the first thing I heard that made sense was the word of Muhammad, peace be upon him. I shouldn't do, I lie, I lie. But God, if my daddy could see me now, chains around my feet, he don't understand that sometimes a man's got to fight for what he believes. And I believe God is great, all praise due to him. If I should die, I'd rise up to the sky just like Jesus, peace be upon him. I shall do, la 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 la. There's no God but God. Were pure and strong, and death filled the air. We all offered the present, prepared for our martyrdom. But I lost. some other plan, some secret not revealed. Now they're dragging me back with my head in the sack to the land of the infidel. I shall do la ilaha illallah. I shall do la ilaha
فإذا لقيتم الذين كفروا فضرب الرقاب حتى إذا أثخنتموهم فشدوا الوثاق.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio CFUV 101.9 FM 104.3 on the cable dial and cfuv.uvic.ca everywhere else. That was Johnny Walker's Blues, the American jihadist, as he was called for a while there, off of Steve Earle's album Jerusalem. Well, I just got through to David Swanson, and funny story. David's taking his wife out to dinner tonight. There was a bit of a mix-up about time zones, and so I'm not going to have David. So I'm just going to, as I'm tap dancing and releasing gas here for the second, I think I'll go back to another track off of Mr. Earle's great album, and then try to improvise something. You'll be amazed when I come back. Trust me.
Ashes to ashes, dust to dust. Ashes to ashes, dust to dust.
Long time ago, for ice and the snow, little giants walked this land. Each step that took the mighty mountains shook, and the trees took a knee, and the seas rolled in. And one day they say the sky gave way, and death rained down and made a terrible sound. There's fire everywhere, and nothing was spared that walked on the land and flew through the air. When it all was over, slate wiped clean with a touch. Their God stood and saw it was good and said, ashes to ashes and dust. And he crawled up on the dirt and stood up and took a look around. Said, I'm the next big thing. The gift that I bring comes directly from God, so ain't no holding me down. So he crowned himself king. Now no one remembers his name, but the seed that he sowed took the show on the road. There was blood on their hands and a plague on the land. They drew a line in the sand and made the last stand. So God made us in his image, and it's in God that we trust. When asked about the men that died by the hands, I said, ashes to ashes and dust to dust. Yeah. tumbles. No matter how strong, no matter how tall, someday even gray walls will crumble. And every idol ever raised falls. Someday even man's best laid plans, a life twisted and covered in rust. We done all that we can, but it slipped through our hands, and this ashes to ashes and dust to dust.
Welcome back to Guerrilla Radio, Farting and Tap Dancing here in the second half with Steve Earle from his disc Jerusalem. That was Ashes to Ashes. I like that tune. That's pretty good. Well, a couple of weeks ago, you may recall, I had Razan Zweiter here. She's a Palestinian a woman who's an exile living in Jordan. She's on the One Woman, 1 Million Trees tour of Canada, trying to raise money for tree planting in Palestine. This is a growing thing now, as well as tourism. There's an organization saying, hey, take your holiday in Palestine. They're trying to bring some semblance of what's normal everywhere else in the world, but for some reason is unthinkable in one place on the planet. Burma excluded. Palestine, you know, why not go there for a holiday? Why not go there and plant trees, or want to go there and help harvest olives? You know, the idea, of course, is to try to bring outsiders in and try to, you know, and economically benefit this this secluded region, forcefully secluded. Well, if you recall the interview I did with her, it was a distant one by phone. That connection was kind of crummy, so it wasn't so good. But I did go down and catch her talk. Now, she was she's the founder and representative of the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature, or APN, and she gave a presentation on the destruction of Palestinian farms and orchards, along with some of the other things, down at the BCGEU. What was that, on the 25th or 26th of October, a week and some odd ago. So I went down there and recorded it. The volumes, the audio isn't perfect, but it's better than the telephone interview I did with her. So I got enough time for about 6 or 7 or 8 minutes. I can only tell you that, you know, she was showing pictures, and so, you know, you won't obviously see the pictures, but the power, it resonated just to see these trees being torn up by settlers who are being protected by soldiers, you know, going in there with chainsaws and limbing and then uprooting trees to move to their own settlements. And these olive trees that they're taking away, they destroy the palms too, but the olive trees that they take away can be, you know, decades or centuries old. And there's something about it that is just intrinsically evil, because it's not only doing damage to the people immediately, but to the future generations. And these trees are very much regarded in that sense, that, you know, she said to me, and Goethe famously said too, if I knew I was to die tomorrow, I'd plant a tree today. And, you know, very moving indeed. So listen to a bit of Razan Zweiter as she speaks to us here in Victoria down at the BCGEU on the 26th of
October. Very much. I'm very happy to be here, and I want to thank you all that you came to listen to us. I'm sure you are interested to listen with me to the agony of the Palestinian farmers. This is the presentation today. I want to thank especially Terry and Gerd. Since I met Terry, like she told you, I felt that we are not alone. And one of the reasons I accepted to come to the conference in Montreal is because Terry and Gerd are here also, and I could see them again and again. My presentation today will be covering three parts. The first part, I'll try to give you some information about what's happening in Palestine. The other part will be what we are doing to face this as people in diaspora, with the help and partnership of people all around the world. And the third part will be to discuss with you what can we do, what possibilities are there to cooperate together to end this apartheid effect on the Palestinian farmers and people. I would like to start with 1 minute.
The glasses of water are behind you there.
Okay, thank you.
this is video of the trees being chainsawed and the farmers begging that they stop cutting down their orchards and their livelihood. Grab around the trunks of the trees, and the men rush in, but are chased back by soldiers with automatic rifles, and there's bulldozers and backhoes doing broader work in the background.
This happens every day. This was shot indirectly without people noticing, without the settlers nor the soldier noticing. But I'm sure you have seen lots of such... Yes. This happens every day. This is just a sample of the agony of the Palestinian farmers.
Believe it or not, we never see it on our news.
Yes, I'm sure, or else it would have stopped. Yes. I was born in Nablus in Palestine. This is my homeland, and this is how I remember this city. It's not anymore like this. The olive tree. Do you know where is the native land, or where is the birth of the olive tree? Well, the olive tree is 6,000 years old, the oldest olive tree to have been planted in history is in our land. It's the land of Palestine, Jordan, and Syria. And it has been well kept, a friend of all, till unfortunately we had the visit of the Zionists to Palestine. Since then, I don't know why, they feel that the olive tree is an enemy, and the uprooting of tree is systematically done every year and every moment to reach up to 1.5 million in the 10 years that I started working, since 2000 till 2007, 7 years. We could calculate, or we could gather the data, that we have 1.5 million lost olive tree. Now, in my information gathering here, I would like to divide it into two parts, the effects on agriculture and the effects on environment. As to agriculture, the atrocities are against the trees and the crops and all natural resources, including, of course, water resources and soil. One very creative way of fighting farmers is the releasing of wild boars. They release wild boars in farms, and they eat the harvest, and they eat the trees. And one might ask, what happens to the Israeli farms and these wild boars attacking them? The Israeli farmers can afford to put fences, and that's why they are safe from the boars. But now we have this problem in Jordan. They are crossing the borders to Jordan, and we have a big threat to the Jordanian farmers because of the wild boars. Now, the water. You know, the water scarcity in our region is very dangerous. In Palestine, it's even more. The Israelis, after the 67 war, 2 months after the occupation, 1967, it's in August, they issued a new law. It's called the 92/15, and it prohibited Palestinian farmers from drilling any wells, from using any source of water without the admission of the occupation authorities. And in 1982, the whole supply of water for the West Bank and Gaza was under the company Mekorot. And this Mekorot is really having fun just allocating the amount of water they think is right. They are giving the Israelis 87% of the water resources and 13% for the Palestinian West Bank and Gaza. We have now, if you want to see the distribution of water, reflects really an apartheid regime, where a 60 liter per person for Israelis versus for Palestinians versus 274 liters for an Israeli, and in Gaza. It used to be 88 liters per person, and the settlers around Gaza used to have 584 liters per person. And the we have 200 villages without running water. They buy their tanks. Not only they are controlling the sources of water, they are also destroying the water tanks, destroying the water lines. And the data you'll see now has been collected up to year 2007. After that, we don't have really accurate data, but you can imagine that the things are worse even. The destruction goes to reservoirs, to all kinds of trees. These people are threatened in their harvest. The cutting of trees. We have calculated the palm trees, the banana trees, the citrus trees, the grape trees. I think you know this picture. This is from a village near my city called Salem, and this is Hafiza, and this also was taken without the knowledge of the soldiers. These trees are taken to be stolen to be planted in settlements. And you see the red mark on the tree. It says that this tree would be sold or would be transplanted to a settlement. And this is how they take it. And we say that they are not patient enough in the settlements to have their own history. So they are stealing the Palestinians' history through their trees.
Well, that's all I got time for tonight, and a disturbing tale indeed told by Razan Zwater. But you can check out their work at the Arab Group for the Protection of Nature at apm.org, or go to my website to hear the rest of that presentation at pacificfreepress.com under the Guerrilla Radio tab, and you can also listen to any number of other programs I've done here over the last little while. That's all I got for you. I want to thank Janine Becker for coming on, and Carmen Chung of the bccla.org if you want to check out their work, or again at pacificfreepress.com. I urge you to stick around this damp evening here if you're not watching the World Series. Maybe I should have said that. Because Arnold's coming straight up to rhythm you into this wonderful autumn-like evening here in Victoria, and it looks like he's got guests tonight too. I'll play myself out again with more from Steve Rose Jerusalem, the title track, and until the next time.
Looked into my heart.